listening to the only daily talk show in North America covering the world of football. This is World Football Daily.
Yes! It hits the back of the net. Oh, my goodness me!
The world's game.
Oh, you're beautiful! What a headshot! What a head!
Our religion.
Brilliant goal! What an equalizer!
Our passion.
Go, go, USA! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
World Football Daily serves up the best football talk 5 days a week.
Oh! You will never, ever see a game quite like this! Unbelievable!
Defending the indefensible. Some people have actually come out and defended footballers diving. We discuss the controversial topic here on World Football Daily. World Cup qualifiers get underway today. Jordan take on the might of Uruguay. And El Tri look to get past New Zealand. We discuss a little bit of the World Cup. And the class of 92, the YouTube trailer is out, but will United ever be able to build that same side again? We have a little think about that as well here on World Football Daily. Welcome to Wednesday's edition of the show. I am Oliver the Deuce Wilson, bringing you the news and, of course, the views from around the global world of football. And it's time to get talking World Cup business, as always, here on the show in these international breaks. We'll be talking about that a little later on. Delighted to say that we'll be talking as well to a very good friend of the show, Mr. Leander Sherlockins, will be joining us to talk about the future of college football, or should I say college soccer, in the USA, and is it still a viable option? We'll also be discussing a little bit of US soccer in general with him today on the show. Defending the indefensible, though, there's a number of people, including, and I'm horrified to say that, including our good friend on the show here, Neil Ashton, have started to defend, not completely defend, because, as I say, I don't think there is any defense for diving, but to almost give the odd justification as to why players do it. Neil said in an article in the Daily Mail this morning that basically players that have been injured, you can understand why they go down easily, why they flinch away from tackles, because they don't want to re-injure themselves. Now, that's a fair point in that, you know, players are almost see the red mist coming from a defender. They see a crunching challenge coming in early. So rather than avoid it, ride the challenge, but end up maybe losing possession, they'd rather kind of dive over the challenge and take the free kick instead. It means they'll keep possession. However, and I have to say, and I apologise, by the way, if I'm if I'm sounding a little awkward there, I'm having a lot of trouble breathing. I'm pretty sure it's in part to do with a back muscle rather than any sort of chest problems that I'm having. But if I keel over during the show, please do not worry about it. Well, or you know, call an ambulance, either one. Players kind of wincing away from challenges. I can understand that. You know, when Ramsey broke his leg in Shawcross, it took him a long time to come back, get his confidence back going into challenges again. You know, I'm sure Stuart Holden, we've seen him kind of maybe not bottle out of challenges, but we've seen him avoid contact at occasions because of the injury problems that he's had. He knows what it's like to suffer a horrific injury, and he wants to avoid having that happen to him ever again. Rightfully so. You know, you don't want to see players getting injured. We don't want to see that at all, and we definitely don't want to see players getting seriously hurt and having possibly career-ending injuries. What we do have, though, is we have players still diving. Now, there's a difference between either shying out of a challenge or avoiding contact and then going over and without being touched. Now, if you go over without being touched, and even if you go down easily, you are cheating because you're allowing minimal contact to give you a maximum contact reaction, or even no contact to give you a maximum contact reaction. That's cheating. That's fooling the referee. Now, Ashton in his piece highlights Dennis Bergkamp's book, who says that it's more a case of trying to bring that contact to the attention of the referee. The fact that that contact shouldn't be taking place, and therefore the player should be having a free kick, but the referee won't see it unless an exaggerated movement is made by the attacker. But again, I don't think you can say that, because if that contact is there, you have, as an attacker, just as much right to maybe push back slightly against the defender that's shoulder barging into you. So you can give as good as you get in those sorts of situations when there's minimal contact. Shirt pulling as well. We see six of one and half a dozen of the other. It's not always a defender that's doing the shirt pulling. It's often the attacker as well. So, and I still think, if you're saying that players are avoiding contact, diving over contact to win free kicks instead of taking the contact, the point is that really frustrates me is that we pay these players a lot of money. We know sport as a occupation has almost that danger that can end at any moment. You look at the classic F1 drivers back in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. You know, you'd have, especially the times of, as we were talking about it on the show, when I went to see the movie Rush, you know, you're talking about that sort of era. The James Hunts, the Nicky Lauders, you know, they had 2-3 men dying a season in that. And they got paid money, not just because it was sport and it was exciting and there was sponsorship, but because as well, there is that danger to it. In the same way, footballers, of course, they get paid a lot of money because they generate money for a football club, winning trophies, winning sponsorship, attracting media attention. But shouldn't part of that money also be the fact that there is danger money to this sport? Because the wrong challenge, the wrong twist of a knee, it could happen in the street, it could happen on a football pitch, and your career could be over. Same way NFL players get a lot of money, there's a minimum salary in the NFL, because there is that danger that it can all be over in a heartbeat. It's one of the reasons why people want college athletes to have salaries as well, because they feel that these players generate a lot of money, but not only that, there is that danger that they will never be able to capitalise on it because of the fact that either they might not make it to the NFL or because of an injury can end that person's career in a second. Sport, going back to the gladiatorial days, you know, was great for athletes, but it also had its danger to it. And I'm not saying we should not try and take the danger out of it. Not at all. I don't, as I say, I don't want to see players getting injured or anything like that. But surely part of the reason why the players get paid such a high wage is because there is that danger to it. Those big players have that, it can end at any moment. So they get that high, big money salary, not just because of sponsorship, but because of the danger money to it as well. And I think that if you're a player that starts kind of diving, cheating away from challenges, and you are cheating, let's not beat around the bush, you are cheating, you don't deserve to be paid that high salary that you get because you're not playing the game. You are cheating your way to success, and you don't deserve the money that you're paid. Which is why we should have fines and bans for players, well, fines and bans for players that do dive, go down easy, and go down under minimal contact. And we should have referees that allow that contact, that physicality in the game, to continue. Just my thoughts. Let us know your thoughts on diving, defending the indefensible, as some people have tried to do in the last few days. Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter, 310-909-8483, and the Facebook page as well. I was actually discussing this with ex-Sheffield Wednesday legend and Crystal Palace legend Mark Bright on the weekend as we were chatting down at White Hart Lane. And he was saying, with the Lloris thing, everybody's made such a big deal about it. But at the end of the day, if you were back in his day, you just played on. If you got a knock to the head, if you were knocked out, he said that he was once knocked out for a few minutes on the pitch, got up, carried on, played the game, and was sat there on a 3-hour coach journey back to London, I believe he was saying it was. And, you know, was sat there feeling rough, feeling sick, almost passing out kind of thing, sat with air coming through the driver's window, sat on the front row of the coach because he felt so bad because he was concussed. But you know what? He carried on and played and finished that game that he was playing in. And are we making too big a deal about the Hugo Lloris incident? It's another question that needs to be brought up, maybe with some, obviously, the professionals, the medical opinion and whatnot. A lot of people saying that Lloris, after being knocked out, should never have been able to play. The decision should have been taken out of the doctor's hands. There should be a rule that means if you get knocked out on the pitch, you aren't able to come on. Another suggestion this weekend was that if your goalkeeper gets knocked out in that fashion and you've made all three substitutions, that you should be allowed to make a fourth substitution and allow your goalkeeper to be changed. Don't agree with that at all. A forced substitution just to allow your goalkeeper to be changed? No, you make your substitutions at your own risk, managers. And if your goalkeeper gets injured, sent off, whatever it is, then you pay the price and you put somebody from outfield in goal. That's just the unfortunate case of being an athlete and putting yourself in those situations where you can get hurt. That's what sport is there. It's not just for the beautiful game. It's because these players put their bodies on the line to entertain us. And really taking sport back to the bare minimum, that's what it is. It's there for our entertainment and entertainment alone. Let's leave it that debate there for the moment, and let's get into a new debate with our guest for today. He's a man who joins us. He's a fantastic writer of all things football. I'm delighted to say we've got him back on the show once again. Joining me here on World Football Daily to talk about US soccer and especially college soccer at the NCAA level, it's Mr. Leander Sherlackens. Leander, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show today, mate. How are you doing? I hope you have been keeping well since your last appearance with us.
The pleasure is mine. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. All the better for hearing your tones down our World Football Daily line today, my man, especially as I want to chat with you about the recent stuff you've been talking about, NCAA soccer, college soccer, and whether it still has a place in the US game. First and foremost, what intrigues you so much about the college system of soccer in the US?
Well, it's really a very pivotal time, I think, in the in college soccer's existence, because it's always been the traditional route to get to professional soccer in America. Coming out of high school, it was either that, sign with a very small sort of semi-pro minor league setup, as guys like Tim Howard did successfully do, but you'd be hard-pressed to find more good examples, or go straight to Europe, which then, as it is now, is a very hard thing to do, especially coming right out of high school. So soccer in college never really had the challenge of having to compete. And now, of course, what you're seeing is that almost every MLS team has a youth academy set up, and certainly all of them are working on it. And you're seeing more and more MLS teams popping up, therefore more academies, and they're taking it more and more seriously. You've got a team like Real Salt Lake even has an out-of-state academy in Arizona. And so you're seeing now, and people in college, if they're being honest, and certainly in the national team setup, acknowledge this, that the really special young players don't go to college anymore. They sign straight from the academy teams their professional papers. They go to the reserve team or even straight into the first team, and they just sort of skip that entire step. Many still use the MLS academies to get into college, and then some of them sign back with MLS afterwards. But it has come a time where you wonder what the best use is for college soccer within the American development scheme, if there is any at all.
The academy system is obviously still growing and still doesn't reach as far a network as the obviously the university system does. There are so many universities in America. But do you think it can truly be completely overtaken potentially by these academy systems?
Well, researching this four-part series that I've been writing, and part four runs on Thursday on foxsoccer.com, I changed my mind on it, to be honest with you. I didn't really rate the college system. I didn't really see its point, and I figured it was a thing of the past and a thing that would soon be outdated and just completely replaced. But what you do have is what you can think of as a bonus system. By my rough estimate, between divisions 1, 2, and 3 in the college game, there are about 20,000 kids, boys, men really, from 18 to 22, 23, playing competitive soccer in a, by and large, a good environment with decent coaching, really good facilities, and good funding. If you take that on top of a traditional professional youth soccer mechanism, the way you have it around the world, you actually have something that's sort of a little extra that you get thrown in there for free just by virtue of how things are traditionally done in America. So I've come to find that if you can find a way to properly integrate the two, that you've really got something that no other country has, that could be a real great benefit. But there's a bit of sorting out to do before then.
You mentioned, obviously, the level of coaching in college there. You said it described it just then as decent. With the growth of Major League Soccer, though, won't these academies be able to afford to have a much higher caliber of coach at these academies? And as MLS increases, the number of academies increases, couldn't that lead to college even getting left further behind because the coaching quality alone won't be able to match up with what the academies can offer?
Well, that's kind of the question. But ultimately, you're also talking about different age groups, and that's the tricky part with this discussion. MLS academies, right now, you're talking 14 to 18. And if they go in the direction that they should, which they seem to, you're soon going to be talking, say, 10 to 18 or even 8 to 18, as those are really critical times. College, of course, is 18 to 22, 23. So there should be a way that they can be integrated better, for instance, by changing college soccer's rule to, you know, to stop the endless substitutions, to allow college players to spend more time with the pro team during the season, to play better games, maybe to play in the reserve leagues, etc. But as for coaching, that's sort of the tricky part, because college pays its coaches quite well. There's a lot of job security, there's a bit of status, you know, you get to travel, they're nice jobs, whereas it's always been hard in America, I think, to keep some of the better coaches for the younger ages. And when you go to Europe, you'll find that in the youth setups, you'll find the best youth coaches are typically coaching ages 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and the former players, the guys who are sort of in line and getting groomed to become senior team managers, are doing the higher age groups and then the reserves. And that's the way it should work, where you have the best coaches at the youngest ages. So that's going to be tricky for college to hold on to the better coaches, but at the same time, it's hard for MLS, I think, to convince really good coaches that their time is best spent coaching 11-year-olds.
Will college soccer, and have we seen, Leander, over the last few years, is that catching up in any way, shape or form in the same way that Major League Soccer has caught up in national US coverage of the sport? Is college soccer growing and growing even more? Because obviously the money gap between things like the NCAA football, as in American football and basketball, is a huge gap at this moment in time. Is it closing ground at all, though?
Well, I think there's a strange dichotomy there, because what you're seeing is that at once college soccer is under threat from the MLS Academy system, but at the same time, it's benefiting from it tremendously, because you've got all these players who've got professional, well, you know, unpaid, but professional level coaching and education in football up until the age of 18, and those guys are not all signing their professional papers at 18. So now suddenly college has this huge pool of players who've gone through really good youth development, really good coaching and training, and really good setups that are now available to them. But at the same time, they're not getting that really special player anymore. So that's, I think, sort of hurting college soccer's visibility, where the real, you know, the next big thing typically in American soccer is not found in college, and that's something that makes it a tougher sell. But at the same time, I think the overall level is rising as the quality of the player there improves thanks to the MLS Academy, and more teams can sort of play nice, fluid soccer that looks more attractive.
Are you seeing college very much like almost English and European clubs use the loan system then, in that, you know, they've got these 18-year-olds coming out of the academies, they can then go to college and play competitive football as opposed to just being stuck on the training pitch time and time again? They're actually getting that invaluable game experience.
Well, it could be that, but it isn't that quite yet because of NCAA's regulations. During the NCAA season, college players who might be still affiliated with an MLS team, and remember that for every year that a player was in an MLS academy, his MLS team retains his rights while he's in college, which is a complicated way of saying that if a guy was in an MLS academy with the Columbus Crew for 3 years, that the Crew retains his rights for his first 3 years of college, which is to say they wouldn't have to draft him, they can just sign him to a homegrown contract. Mm. But there could be much better integration if the NCAA were to make an exception, which, as we all know, is very unlikely, but this could be a solution, where it would allow players that are affiliated to professional teams to also train with their professional clubs during the college season, and perhaps play with the reserve team during the spring and the summer. That would solve a lot of problems, because what you're seeing in college is that guys are actually not getting enough quality repetitions because the season is so short, and they're not getting enough quality games because they're typically playing 15 to 20 games in the fall and at most 6 games in the spring. And of those games, not a lot of them are very high quality in terms of their adversaries. So if you could integrate those two, then college soccer could be a really good breeding ground and could be kind of a lower league loan system that would really benefit everybody in the end. But that would require, I think, quite a lot of rule changes from the NCAA.
And just kind of to wrap up the college football aspect, Leanne, I mean, players in Europe, you get spotted at 16, 14, maybe even younger, and you get brought through these academies. You hit 18, 19, 20, that's your time to go and shine and to make sure you embed yourself at kind of a career level to become a professional footballer. Major League Soccer's got that with the academies. What does college give? Because you've got these guys, you know, maybe coming out of college at 23 years old, 24. Could that be almost too late for them for their careers?
Well, that's an interesting question, and that kind of strikes to the heart of it. I think that the future of college is going to be sort of a backdoor route into professional soccer for the late bloomers and the overlooked. And I talked to a lot of guys for this story, and I talked to Eddie Pope, a longtime MLS and national team defender. And he said, when I was in college, I went to the Olympics, and we got destroyed by Argentina because we were all college players or rookies, and they'd all been professionals for 4 or 5 years. I spoke to Tab Ramos, one of the few American prodigies, and he said, I didn't leave college any better than I entered it. But I also spoke to a guy like Matt Beasler, who said, if I hadn't gone to college 4 years, I probably wouldn't have made it as a pro. So that's where I think college has a value, where it's sort of like the second chance circuit for all the guys who just aren't ready at 18, and that could be a real benefit if it's employed properly.
If you were to encourage a player then, at this moment in time, your personal advice after looking at this, and obviously we look forward to your fourth part of this four-part series coming up on Thursday, what would your advice be to young players that are maybe around about that 16, 17? I know obviously you're not a scout or anything like that, Leander, but you've obviously done the research and know what you think would be the best option for these guys.
Well, if they have a sense that they're going to get serious minutes in the first team and the reserve team, go pro. If you're not looking at that right now, if you need more time to mature, then there are some college programs that are a really good alternative that can offer a few years of incubation with good coaching and good facilities, especially if you can retain a connection with your professional team and train there in the summer, then that's a good alternative too. So it really depends on what stage a player is in his development. As you know, as it is in England, you know, you've got the Wayne Rooneys who are ready to play when they're 16, and you've got other guys, the Ricky Lamberts, say, who are ready to play when they're 30. So it just depends entirely on the player, but I think both are viable routes right now.
Just quickly, actually, on that maturity level as well, I mean, obviously, people that go to college, and I know for a fact that when I was at university at college, you know, you grow up a lot. Will that help, do you think, players coming through the NCAA route rather than going through an academy route straight to 18, professional contracts? Obviously not a huge amount of money, but still playing a sport professionally and the ego, the swagger that can bring. Do you think NCAA players coming through into Major League Soccer and the professional game are slightly to be a little bit more level-headed because they've gone through that 18, 19-year-old stage, still working hard for free playing this game and then are reaping the rewards a little later?
Absolutely, and I think that's a really good point. And you see that with guys that have come through college. It's just a nice intermediate step between what is ultimately youth soccer and professional soccer. And what you're also finding is guys that have gone off to college, you know, the point of college, is, aside from the soccer aspect, is to learn people how to think. And they're ultimately just a bit more well-rounded and thoughtful than guys who might have skipped college. And I think that's helpful in a professional career, too.
It is an interesting point, Leander. Very interesting indeed as well, of course, are the games coming up this weekend and the USA taking to the friendlies, a very nice, comfortable cruise through the hexagonal round, and Jurgen Klinsmann's released his side. Are you surprised, Leander, about any of the names at all? Of course we weren't going to see the likes of Dynamo SKC players and Timbers players as well, and the RSL folk in this squad. But are you surprised by any of the call-ups? Bill Hamid, Sean Johnson in there alongside Tim Howard, no Brad Guzan, of course, not an opportunity for him to shine.
Yeah, no, what I am actually slightly surprised that none of the MLS players that are still in competition, that are in the conference finals, are in the squad, purely for the fact that they changed the schedule so that the conference finals wouldn't interfere with these international games. So I kind of think, what's the point of that if you're not going to call in any of the players that are involved still? But at the same time, I was surprised not to see Landon Donovan and a few guys like that. They're said to have niggling injuries, but you're getting to a point now where you're, you know, the World Cup is 7 months away, and from what I hear, and I'd have to double check this, but Landon Donovan, Michael Bradley, Clint Dempsey, and Jozy Altidore have never played in the same game or have never played at the same time under Jurgen Klinsmann yet. And this has been a problem under Klinsmann, the continuity in the team, where you've constantly, I mean, Donovan obviously took a sabbatical. You had Dempsey, when he came back stateside, he had some fitness issues, and then he frankly had some form issues. Michael Bradley's just had an injury. So what you're seeing that some of the really core players have just not had all that much time together yet. Jermaine Jones may or may not need surgery. So you've got a bunch of guys that you're going to be counting on in Brazil that just aren't all that familiar with each other lately. And certainly they know each other well from campaigns past, but that would be a concern to me. And that is a tad surprising about the squad, that that he hasn't brought in more of the regulars, even if they're not fit to play, you know, 90 minutes against both Scotland and Austria, to even at least be in the squad and to train together and to be more familiar with each other. Because it's getting to be that time where you really want to be putting the final touches on your squad, I think.
Do you think Jurgen is likely to throw those players in together in Brazil if they haven't played a game alongside each other? Do you think he will just go for what is his on paper starting 11, or he'll go for the players that have had that chemistry in victories during the hexagonal and, of course, in the friendlies post that?
Well, if Jurgen is nothing else, he's unpredictable, so that's hard to that's hard to foretell. I think he'll have enough confidence in all of those guys, even if they haven't played together all that much, to put them in. But at the same time, he's really prized guys forming partnerships and relationships on the field, and he'll keep certain tandems together if they work well, even if that means they're not necessarily the best players on the team. So it's hard to say exactly what he plans on doing, but he'll come up with a plan certainly, and just deploy it without really giving it without worrying about it very much, because that seems to just sort of be his nature. What will be interesting about these upcoming games is that some guys, it seems, are sort of in the last chance saloon there, where Eric Lehi, for instance, Breck Shea, maybe to some extent Sasha Kleston and Chris Wondolowski, they've all been called in. So maybe he's treating these games also as sort of a last open tryout for the World Cup.
And just finally, Leander, we've taken up far too much of your time, but I want to get this quick one in. You touched on it a few moments ago about the changing of the playoff schedule to fit in the international break, and so it wouldn't be affected by the international break at all. But Jason Kreis saying that he'd have loved to have carried on playing probably straight away after that victory against Portland in the Western Conference final first leg. I'm sure Portland are happy for the break. What do you make of the MLS playoffs, maybe not capitalizing on the fever that had been generated by a number of playoff games close together, getting media attention, then suddenly perhaps maybe losing the wind, losing the gusto slightly around it because of this international break?
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, you make a really good point there, because I was just thinking that. I mean, you've got now some teams that are on a run and some interesting momentum, and you've got some fun storylines and some attention for it, and now it stops and the wind goes out of the sails, and then they have to start over again. I think either they should have found a way to get the playoffs in entirely before the break or after the break, or just have not respected the break, which I don't think is the best option. But certainly the state of suspension right in the middle of the playoffs is deflating.
Well, let's hope that it doesn't deflate you too much, and let's hope that it doesn't deflate the attention that Major League Soccer has been garnering over the last few weeks, nor deflate the US men's national team as they get set to take on Scotland. I'm sure it's going to be a little tougher than it was last time out for them. Leander, though, we appreciate you coming on the show today to have a chat with us. If anybody hasn't seen them, get onto Fox Soccer and have a read of them. They're fantastic, the four-part series that Leander's put together on the state of college soccer in the US. And we look forward to catching up with you again very soon indeed, my man.
Sounds good. Anytime. It was my pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Leander Sherlock in there joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things
US football. And of course, looking at, as I said, in that big series that he's been doing on foxsoccer.com about the state of college football. I'm still not convinced by it, though. I do think the academies will end up taking over. You can follow Leander on Twitter at capital L, Leander, last name, no fit. All one word, capital L, capital L, capital N, capital N, capital F, i.e. capital L on Leander, capital L on last, capital N on name, capital N on no, and a capital F on fit. Leander, last name, no fit. Fantastic Twitter handle, that's for sure. Big thanks there to Leander for joining us, taking us through a little bit of the college aspects of
Do you believe him, Juice? Do you believe him?
I don't know. The rise of academies seems to be dominating ahead of the college game, doesn't it?
Sure. The Matt Belzer fact was kind of interesting. I mean, the fact that he comes out and says, look, I was better for, you know, going through college. I needed college to grow kind of, you know, emotionally, almost maturely, you know.
Well, we always say that these young players get too much money thrown at them. And I've always said that college players in sports like the NFL and stuff, they have so much TV attraction to them whilst they're in college, yet it's kind of a sign of maturity that these kids will make it in the NFL if they can stay out of trouble and get themselves to the NFL without causing problems with all of that media exposure. It does help them grow up very quickly and learn. Obviously, it's not the same as NCAA soccer, because, you know, it's just nowhere near as big. But the whole college experience does help you learn being out on your own away from family very quickly. And you do a lot of growing up at college. I think everybody that goes to college will agree that you do become your own person. You start to really kind of find out what you're about and how you deal with yourself in the real world. So I get that. But I just think the academy systems could do that as well, can help you grow up. They can still help with your education, as well as giving you a better quality of football coaching. That's all I think. I do like Leander's points, but I'm going to be sticking with myself on this one and saying that, you know what, how, yes, it helps the kind of the older generation of athletes, but at the same time, you know, that it's very difficult. As we know from European football, you know, it's very difficult once you hit 22, 23 to suddenly be take Ricky Lambert as the exception that proves the rule. You know, suddenly 31 and finally getting the credit he deserves. But it's very difficult if you're not one of those talents that comes through and people notice at 18, 19. And I think that's a big difference. And I don't think you would get the exposure or the attention playing in NCAA soccer. But that's just my points of view. Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 3109098483 in the Facebook page as well. That's right, Facebook. It's better than Facebook because it's Bok. We obviously have the international playoffs kicking off today. We're talking about that yesterday with Kim Tate on the show. You heard the lineup here first, hopefully. Depends when you download the podcast, of course. But you heard it here first if you were listening to us early on World Football Daily yesterday. Mexico naming their starting 11 to take on New Zealand. Herrera in that press conference. And Jordan taking on Uruguay this afternoon in a few hours' time. So Raf, are we going to see an upset in either one of these World Cup qualification games?
No. I think Uruguay are going to handle Jordan. That's not even... I worry that could get a little out of hand. Mexico and New Zealand should get out of hand, in my opinion. But I think, like I said yesterday, Mexico are going to ultimately play down to their opposition and make this a lot tougher than it needs to be, even with their so-called not best of the best talent, you know, showing up on the pitch. I think that they have the talent, you know, in the pool that they've taken. I mean, yeah, they should easily dispatch of New Zealand. I think they're going to make it a little bit harder than it needs to be. And I'm sorry, New Zealand. I'm not trying to knock you, but I mean, you know, it's Mexico. Mexico should be dispatching of you.
Yeah, we've said that though all hexagonal though, haven't we, Raf? We've said Mexico should be doing this, and they haven't done it. And new manager, yes, as Kim said yesterday, you know, they've had time to kind of gel a bit more as a squad and get themselves together. But do you really you're that convinced that Mexico are going to get through this without struggling?
No. Like I said, they will struggle through this, and they're going to make it a lot tougher than it needs to be. But they're going to get through. I mean, if they come together, if they dominate the game like they should, it could be a potential, and I'm saying both legs, of course, that could be a potential turnaround for this Mexican side heading into Brazil this summer. Otherwise, you know, I almost feel like they don't deserve to be going, Juice. I'm very disappointed and let down just by their performance. And it's really, really frustrating. I mean, seriously, no matter whether I look at it as an American or as a Mexican-American, you know what I mean? Like, it's incredibly frustrating.
Is it not a bit unfair as well on New Zealand? Because obviously CONCACAF, you know, they get the obviously way more than one qualification spot, whereas the Australasian Oceanic Federation do only get that one spot that goes into a playoff. Is it not fair? You know, you would have thought New Zealand have beaten away everybody that's come and tested them for these fixtures. Why not let them just take their rightful place in the World Cup rather than in all seriousness, though, they want to make it a World Cup, you know, and there's been talk about you know, obviously expanding it so there's a bigger outreach, but rather than doing that, to make it, give it a bigger outreach, give them that automatic spot into the World Cup.
I mean, you could almost say give more representatives, yeah, but I see your point, Juice. I see your point.
Maybe not more representatives, but at the moment, they're not even guaranteed one representative. So give them at least guaranteed one. You know, that's the reason why Australia moved off to the Asian Conference. A, because they were always winning the Oceanic Conference, and B, because they had a spot that were basically guaranteed and didn't mean they'd have to play somebody like the US, like I don't know, one of the CONCACAF guys to get into the World Cup, you know, which they did a few times anyway, but it meant that, you know, if they get into an automatic spot, they're automatically there. They don't have to deal with all this rubbish. And I just think it's a little harsh on that conference. It's a poor conference in terms of football. It's not beat around the bush.
Sure.
When you've got Tahiti, New Caledonia, New Zealand, the Solomon Islands is kind of the big...
You know, you could even make the argument, Juice, and I don't know why I'm trying to come up to your defense a little bit here on this argument, but by affording them the opportunity to compete at the World Cup, you're going to be bettering the skill level of those players and going back to, you know, your region and spreading it. I mean, you could make the argument that it's almost hindering their development as a region. So, yeah, I mean, at this point, to me, I think I'm more kind of not sad, but or upset. I don't know. I'm indifferent at the whole fact that it's essentially a worst of the worst game. Like, this is going to be, you know, the lowest of the low seed, I guess. I don't know. It's really kind of depressing from a Mexican standpoint.
It's I don't know. It's just a bit hard luck. I do feel sorry for New Zealand. News elsewhere, of course, Raf. I guess I'm assuming that Mexico will get past New Zealand over two legs. I would love to see New Zealand, though, come to the Azteca tonight and make a game of it. Really. No, like, really test them. You know, put up a solid brick wall, try and hit on the counter-attack, play that classic kind of a wayside European Champions League tie mentality over two legs, and then go back and cause them problems on the road. Make Mexico actually have to go away on the road and win something. Although, having said that, it's been the Azteca that's been their downfall in these last few games, that's for sure. Especially during the hexagonal, was not a fortress as it once was for them. And I think, yes, with the Uruguay fixture, I think we all know
it's pretty straightforward there, buddy.
yeah, it could get awkward. Could get awkward that one.
Could get really bad.
News from elsewhere around the footballing globe, though, my man. And we mentioned yesterday on the show the proposed move that United are thinking about making to send Kagawa back to Dortmund, which ludicrous in my eyes. But if they pull this off, if they bring in Marco Reus and Gundogan on the way through, with Kagawa going back the other way, and obviously plenty of cash as well. Now United are looking elsewhere around the world once again, and a surprising name popping up on David Moyes' transfer picking, if so to speak. Iniesta, my man. Manchester United, as a new deal delays on Iniesta's contract with Barca, looking to bring in Andreas into Old Trafford for next season. Now, firstly, do you think it's a smart move by Manchester United to try and bring in somebody like Iniesta? Actually, yeah, let's go with that first, Raf. I've got to say,
yeah.
No way. Don't
really.
Not at all. It's a guy that is. Look, he's not old. Let's not beat around the bush. You know, he's not beyond his years. But this is a guy that, much like Xavi, has played a lot of football, a lot of high tempo, quality football in the last few years, and I genuinely think that that he can't handle a full season club and country, he can. Look, he can to an extent, but I also think, you know, he's going to be getting over that 30 mark, and we already see that he and Xavi need kind of rotating at this moment in time. Mm-hmm. And United don't really want somebody that needs rotating a lot of the time. What they want is somebody to come in and anchor that midfield game in, game out, and be able to play Champions League, FA Cup, Premiership games full 100% all the time. And you're almost jumping on a bandwagon that's far too late if you're Manchester United with Iniesta. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, get on that, you know, press that option hard, but they sure haven't done that. And this is now going to be a chap who, as I say, much like Xavi, is going to be starting to need more and more rest as the season goes on. Like I say, at 29, he's not over the hill, but he's starting to get to the top of that hill, and it's going to be on the way down over the next kind of 3 years or so.
You make a very valid point, Juicen, in the fact that he's played just an insane amount of minutes, competitive minutes, highly competitive minutes, of highly, you know, a world-class football man.
And the unfortunate thing is, as well, is that because he's been playing for Barca and for Spain at this period of time, every year, you know, he's going pretty much all the way in every competition that he plays in.
Every competition, every international friendly that he's having to just attend, the miles that he tracks a year, the, you know, I'm saying like frequent flyer miles, like it's insane.
Well, it's not like going to a World Cup and having, you know, the group stage and then the rest of the time off. It's like going to a World Cup and we are in it for the long haul kind of thing.
Right. So my question would be, well, first concern is that there's a lot of talk of United in the transfer window, and I'm not sure if I'm just kind of recognizing it now, or if I just don't remember it when Sir Alex was, you know, at the helm. I feel like, you know, we just heard of when Manchester United signed people, and that was it. You know, I could be making that up, Juice. I don't know, but I feel like there's just been a ton of talk, especially through the summer, with a lack of execution, and it's very similar to what I see in my own club, Rangers. A lot recently, we talk about, oh, we're talking about this player and he might be interested in coming to, you know, to Rangers, and we won't land them, or we will, or it doesn't matter. But just, you know, why does everybody need to, you know about my transfers and who I'm looking at and stuff like that? I don't want that to be very public personally. And I think that if you're a Manchester United, I'm not sure you want that either. My second point would be that they could, I like it in theory, because ultimately, you know, maybe they're trying to fall under that Pochettino Spanish flair that the Saints have been kind of utilizing, tapping into that same success that even Juan Mata has found at Chelsea. I like the theory. I think that he could actually play a pretty powerful role at Manchester United, because it is a Premier League. It is a very exciting, fast-paced league, but I think that he could, interestingly enough, boss that midfield whenever called upon. And I think that he'd have plenty of breaks, you know, throughout the early stages of FA Cups. I think he could play a vital role for David Moyes.
Barca's dominance against English clubs is, it's just not true. They don't dominate English clubs. And I think that actually Iniesta in the Premier League might see more of the same of that, with even less time on the ball, and obviously wouldn't be able to play the same kind of football, because he'd be in a completely different new setup that wouldn't be playing that Barcelona style of football that he loves and enjoys and thrives in so well. I don't think it would be an easy transition period for Iniesta. And I think that it could easily take him a year or so to get used to it. And by then you're suddenly looking at a guy that, yes, is starting to get maybe a little over the hill. Iniesta, no doubt he could play a big role in any football squad, because he's a fantastic football player. But whether it would be able to happen quick enough in England, especially as we know how Barca and teams like that do struggle against English opposition in European football. More of the same, and probably some heftier challenges coming in from the likes of some of those mid-table sides as well. And I really think that Iniesta, you're suddenly looking at not a, it just wouldn't be the same shine. I think it's the same reason why Lionel Messi quite rightly turned down this Adidas move that we were talking about, of Adidas trying to pay half his buyout fee to get him to Chelsea, Madrid, or Munich, and Chelsea seemed like the likely suitors at that point. And I think he just knows that, you know, at Barca he's got it too good. He's got a situation of football where he knows exactly what's going to happen at each moment on the pitch. It's a league that suits him because Barca and Madrid can pretty much or should be able to dominate the majority of the rest of the sides in that league, Atletico Madrid aside, and maybe some of the others such as Villarreal at this moment in time. But I think you're looking at... I don't think this would be the smart option. I think Gundogan and Royce, obviously that's... that's an immense move, especially bringing in Marco Reus. Sure. But to me, that Dortmund move, as I said yesterday, just depresses me. It really does just make me sad that a side like Dortmund can go through this whole rebuilding process, get this side like it is. It's already said that Lewandowski is going to be moving off at the end of this mm-hmm. year, and I hope that either Edin Dzeko or Christian Benteke are one of the players that comes and fills that role, because I think they could both thrive in that position at Dortmund. But I do think it's sad if the likes of Royce, if the likes of Gundogan do start, you know, flaying the ship as well, like Götze did, and it suddenly just completely it nullifies the point of that rebuilding process, because they've got Dortmund obviously to this great point, two league titles in the last 3 years, a Champions League final appearance, and suddenly it looks like it won't be able to continue because everybody with money starts taking notice and starts throwing their weight about financially to tear that team up. It's just sad, man. It's a sad state of affairs that we find world football in at the moment.
Do you think Kagawa would go back and be successful?
I think Kagawa wouldn't need to go anywhere and be successful. I think he could be successful wherever he plays. He's an excellent footballer. I think at Manchester United he could be successful if he got given any time on the pitch. I mean, that's the real problem, is that he just doesn't get a game. Which is, you know, again, ludicrous. Don't understand that. But David Moyes, of course, probably does, especially with his Arsenal win on the weekend. I'm sure he won't be changing too much.
I had a couple questions for you, if you don't mind. First off, are you calling in a game tonight? There's some interesting games in Brazil. I mean, if you were calling, I think it'd be pretty fantastic. Grêmio and Vasco da Gama, for instance, or Sao Paulo Flamengo. Jeez, just saying, man. Throwing that out there. Are you calling anything this week?
No. I am covering a bit of Chilean football on Friday night, Saturday morning. Rangers de Talca taking on Deportes Iquique. So
our great Chilean brothers, Rangers de Talca. Nice.
I don't think there's an affiliation between the club. But no, that's the only game that I'm covering this week during the international break. So I will get the opportunity to watch some football.
Now, I had kind of texted you this, I think, the other day, but like I'd really wanted to ask you personally, and I think you can kind of talk to Carlo Garganese about this tomorrow. But I don't know if we just kind of brushed over this or not, but Roma's two last results, two draws, one away, one at home. Are we missing this? Is this kind of any news at all? Should we be worried? Are they going to bounce back after this international break? Or is it going to kind of unwind?
That is obviously a fantastic question that I'm going to definitely sit on the fence on. Because this Roma side has taken us by surprise so much this start of this season. I think we all got to the point where we were starting to say, is it flash in the pan? And then as soon as we started to believe that it wasn't, that this Roma side is going to, you know, 10 games, and we were talking about it earlier on with Giancarlo Rinaldi and others from our Italian kind of correspondents that we have coming on the show. And they've all kind of said to us, well, actually, this run could go on for a long time because they've got mm-hmm. you know, some pretty nice games coming up. They've beaten already some of the big sides in Serie A, and they've got a good run of games. They could be unbeaten and possibly on that winning streak until Christmas. That obviously got cut short by the goal at Torino. That gave them only a 1-1 draw away from home in a ground where they've pretty much dominated Torino over the last few years. And then, as you say, this weekend, Roma not getting the job done again. That 1-1 draw against Sassuolo as well. I mean, we saw Inter what, they put 7 past them earlier on in the season? Absolutely crucified this Sassuolo side. On the road as well, Inter did. Roma, on the other hand, in the Estadio Olimpico, you just wonder, I always like to think of maybe the overconfidence side of it. You know, you get to 10 games, and the way the Roma fans and players celebrated, you know, making history, winning the first 10 games of the Italian season, an absolutely incredible feat. And it very much was treated, though. It reminded me of when Arsenal celebrated winning the Champions League. It was like, you haven't really won anything. You know, they celebrated getting to the Champions League even at Newcastle on the last day of the season. Yeah, no, because they hadn't won anything. They hadn't won a piece of silverware. They were just really happy that they were in that top four spot and in the Champions League for the following year. And the same thing with Roma. You know, they were celebrating the fact they'd broken a record, but it's like, you've not won anything yet. You know, you've broken a record. That's fantastic, a great achievement.
So your name is penciled into the history books until the next person. Basically.
You'll be down until Juventus next season go on an 11-game winning streak at the start of the season or something like that. Or until a side of that ilk of Juventus, Napoli, Fiorentina or something like that has a pretty comfortable opening 10 games of the season, as Roma have had for... maybe it's a harsh to say comfortable because, as I say, they have played some of the top sides, including Inter. But at the same time, it's there have been those very much easier games to take. They say no game is easy, but you'd have expected Sassuolo to be an easy game for Roma. So I just wonder if the mentality maybe changed slightly, over belief, so to speak, over confidence in themselves and their ability. Either way, this draw against Sassuolo, not going to plan in any way, shape or form. And I think most people are on, most people have been thinking that Roma now can get this done. They've fallen, but they've also been distracted by how Juventus have, after they've had maybe some complacency at the start of the Italian Serie A season, have started to start grinding the gears again. Fiorentina, Napoli and Juventus have started getting wins together in the last few weeks. Obviously, Juventus beating Napoli on the weekend, and that was a big victory that's pulled them within a point of Roma. And it's just kind of shown that those 10 games, it didn't get them far enough away from the pack, and they have been chased right back down again inside 2 games. And I think that's the other thing, is that we've also been paying quite a lot of attention to the pack that's been following them. I think I said it the other week after they won their 10 games. It's almost like a peloton. You know, those sides need to start... Oh, no, this was about Arsenal, actually, in the Premier League. But those sides need to start knocking points and just slowly winding them, Roma, Arsenal, these sides that have started to pull away during the season, down as a group. They need to start, you know, taking points off Roma, hoping that they stumble every so often, and maintain their winning streaks to, as a group, close that gap and suddenly bring them back into touching distance. And that's exactly what they have done. And I think especially the result that Juventus had against Napoli, the fantastic goal by Paul Pogba, a great performance by Juventus that was led by Pogba. I do think that the Sassuolo result maybe went a little under the radar because of the big games that took place in Italy. But no doubt, I definitely pricked up my ears when I was listening and heard that result, and have been having a gander at what took place in that game over the weekend. It just wasn't the same real Roma performance that we've seen throughout this season. You know what, they were last few minutes and they end up conceding. But I think that's just, again, that comes into that mentality thing. You know, you need to be able to stick it out for a full 90 minutes. But I'm interested to see how they bounce back from these two results as well. Right. Because these, in theory, after the international break, should fire them up, really fire them up to come back and take on Cagliari on the 25th of November, just a month until Christmas when Roma play their next game. Mm-hmm. And that will be able to see, I think, where this Roma side is kind of mentally, if they let it hit them and slump, or if they kind of kick straight back on and continue there. And they still haven't lost. Remember that, Raf. It's not a bad start to the season just because they've drawn 2 games. They still haven't lost.
To be honest, I'm kind of under the idea that potentially, you know, maybe they were a little bit gassed. It takes a lot to win all those games, you know. And like you said, they had some big victories in that 10 game streak. So, you know, I think that, yeah, getting to that I guess milestone of the record at 10 games was one thing, and I think that obviously kind of just it it caught up to them, I think, a little bit. Then the Torino draw happened. You know, they a little stunned, perhaps, a little disorganized, and a little kind of just, you know, hit, knocked a little bit off their perch. And then when Sassuolo came, I think that was a potential kind of major dagger. And if they're not careful, you know, this international break, it should be completely beneficial for them. They should be able to completely recharge themselves, kind of, you know, bring back players into the fold, and really have a chance of you know, keeping that pace up and maybe kind of steadying it out a little bit so that they can maintain a run at the top. Otherwise, Juice, yeah, man, their season could be spiraling down pretty quickly.
I don't think we'll see a spiral down quickly, but I do think it's going to take a little bit of mental courage for this side to just kick themselves back into gear once again. Raf, before we shoot, last thing to talk about, the Manchester United documentary. I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Senna. Absolutely incredible movie about the life of Ayrton Senna, taken from video archive footage of him racing, of old interviews, etc., and put it all together. It's fantastic. The guys that made that have made a documentary, The Class of 92. Yes, that's right. This glorious Manchester United class that keeps on being discussed year after year after year is back again with a full-on documentary about them, new interviews with Beckham, Giggs, Nicky Butt, Paul Scholes, and the Neville brothers as well. And they talk about what it was like to grow up during that time as Manchester United players, where their careers have taken them on since then, and what it was like playing for United as a group that all played football together in that class of 92. Now, Raf, first and foremost, are you going to go and watch this when it comes out?
I'm not going to make it a family night out or anything like that, Juice. I will find a way to watch it eventually. I enjoy me a good football movie, Juice. And for some reason, I feel like, you know, a good football movie is kind of few and far between. And I'm not saying it has to be like an entertaining movie. I'm not talking about a goal movie.
I'm not talking about
your Green Street Hooligans. This is a
fantastic documentary more than anything else, really, isn't it? So there won't be any of that bull Hollywood kind of, oh, and the winning goal. Blah. You know, it's all legit. God, that sounds so... Yeah, man, it's legit. It's legit.
Legit, son.
Yeah, straight up streets of Manchester.
Yeah, I get you. I mean, Juice, I watched the damn United. Like, you know, I can appreciate history. I can appreciate a strong documentary. It doesn't really matter what the subject is, you know.
Somebody was telling me today that they weren't going to watch it because they're an Arsenal fan. They said, we're sick and tired of having that class of 92 rubbed down our throats. What it does look, it looks like a really interesting piece of work that I will definitely be checking out when I can. But B, this class of 92 gets celebrated and celebrated. But have United have never brought in that kind of class comes around, you know, one in a million almost, having those great players, you know, two good players, brothers, a star like Beckham, a workhorse like Nicky Butt. No matter what you say about the point of his career after Manchester United, when he was at United, key part of that. And obviously a legend like Ryan Giggs and somebody with the quality of Paul Scholes, you know, that doesn't come around very often. But especially in recent years, United have started to slip away. You know, those players coming through the academy, Ferguson saying Phil Jones could be one of the greatest ever United players. It doesn't look like that way. Johnny Evans expected to do a lot more than he has done at this point in his career. You look at Nick Powell, who was brought in and has immediately been shipped away and is actually doing really well at Wigan out on loan, especially in the Europa League this season. You look at Paul Pogba, you know, apparently didn't have the right attitude. I guarantee Fergie probably had arguments with people like Neville, both Nevilles, like Giggs, like Beckham, in their youth. And I'm sure, you know, right or wrong attitude, that, you know, those are great players that have let go. Paul Pogba, Ravel Morrison, you know, two players that after leaving Manchester United have just started to shine through on the big stage with other clubs, especially Pogba after the performance he put in the weekend, and B, how he really galvanised that squad during last season for Juventus and playing that nitty-gritty role. So, the United, will it ever produce, that academy, produce anything close to what that class of 92 was? Not just because of those players coming through together, but the fact that there seems to be United scouting, that academy, seems to be missing the trick here at the moment in terms of these players and the ideas of maybe upholding that kind of nobody's bigger than Manchester United. Yes, nobody is bigger than United. And when players start coming in and saying, I want 60 grand a year, otherwise I'm leaving, you know, you need to kind of make your stand at that point if you believe what's good and right in football. But at the same time, do you not think that they're sacrificing a number of quality players, and how much would they love somebody like Paul Pogba right now in the heart of their midfield?
I mean, all valid points, Juice. It's hard to argue with you there, Juice. I'm sorry. You make a stunning argument.
It's just, I just think that United, that class of 92, it is magnificent, but you just wonder if maybe it would have happened in this modern day Manchester United squad. I'll let that be up to the listeners to decide. A big thank you for today's show, both to you, Rafa, and of course to our great guest, Leander Sherlackens, for joining us and talking all things US and college soccer ball. A big thank you to you guys, the listeners, well, and always getting involved on Twitter, on Facebook, and of course the emails and the rant line to show@worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter, 310-998-483 is the rant line, and the Facebook page as well. I'm still having trouble breathing today, and it's not because of the excitement about the World Cup football coming up in the next few days, although Zlatan against Ronaldo is getting a lot of people's blood pumping to some very peculiar places. We'll be talking about that as the week continues, as we look ahead to World Cup playoffs. Remember, it's Mexico, El Tri, taking on New Zealand tonight, and of course Uruguay kicking off their World Cup qualification campaign as well, the final leg. Do you think Suarez's boys, can they make it six? I mean, without saying too harsh, but Jordan aren't. Yeah, I think it could be six or seven for Uruguay. Although they are away in Jordan, so maybe home field
five. Advantage.
Five, yeah, call it five. That kicks off in a few hours as well. Enjoy the football today, guys, and we will catch you at the same time tomorrow. Have a good one.